There's a general consensus in the West and perhaps all around the world that the rich, the elite, can get away with almost anything, whether it's income tax evasion, money laundering, or even the sexual exploitation of children. There often seem to be two standards of justice, one for the very wealthy and powerful, and another for the rest of us. What happens when that's actually true and serious crimes have been committed? Is that kind of system even sustainable? Perhaps not. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Jeffrey Epstein became a household name in the United States years ago. Epstein, for many years, had a reputation as a self-made multimillionaire investor and investment advisor who owned the biggest private residence in New York City, as well as his own private island in the Caribbean. He traveled in those rarefied circles that put him in regular contact with other super-rich businessmen, with politicians, world leaders, even royalty. But that began to fall apart nearly 20 years ago when Epstein was credibly charged with a sex crime against a child. For most anybody, life would have come to a screeching halt then. But Epstein's prosecutor was told to give him special treatment, that he was connected to very powerful people, and that he should serve only a short period of time in a comfortable local jail rather than a prison. That sweetheart deal did nothing to change Epstein's behavior. And in the following years, he continued to build and even to strengthen his relationships. His friends and regular visitors to his private island infamously included former President Bill Clinton, the UK's Prince Andrew, Microsoft company co-founder Bill Gates, physicist Stephen Hawking, and many, many others. And finally, a few years ago, several courageous women came forward to say that Epstein was engaged in the sex trafficking and exploitation of minors and in pedophilia. The negative press was too much, and he was finally arrested and charged with serious felonies, which, if he were to be convicted, would have kept him in prison for the rest of his life. But before he could be tried, Epstein killed himself in prison in New York. At least we think he killed himself. Many, many questions remain unanswered. What was the actual source of his money? Was he an agent working for foreign intelligence? Who was it that ordered that Epstein be given a sweetheart deal after his first arrest? Why was he being protected, and by whom? And perhaps most importantly, why is it nearly 5 years after his death that we still do not know who among the rich and powerful were connected to him? Christopher Halali is a PhD candidate in philosophy and China government scholar for Sino-US cultural communication at Tongji University, and he's an independent investigative journalist. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, John. Pleasure to be with you.
Good to see you, Chris. Chris, there are so many different issues to sort through here. I want to point out at the outset that the reason we're speaking with you about this issue is that you've done a great deal of research into it, and you have unique, perhaps proprietary information about the so-called Epstein black books and about the people connected to him. So let's start at the beginning. Jeffrey Epstein was a nobody from the middle class with no real expertise in finance. He didn't even have a college degree. How did he make such vast amounts of money? Where did that money come from?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. And I think that that's what we're currently trying to piece together. Of course, it's very difficult to go back to Jeffrey Epstein's early life and to find, number one, people that are willing to speak, number two, any real evidence that exists from that time period. And what we end up, the picture we end up painting and sort of the pieces that sort of form the mosaic are that, of course, Jeffrey Epstein graduates a normal, regular high school in New York City, ends up getting a scholarship from what we know to Cooper Union, ends up dropping out, and then, of course, ends up getting a job that was given to him by Donald Barr, who is the father of William Barr, who was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump. And he gets this teaching position to teach math at the Dalton School, which is one of these very high-end preparatory schools in New York that sort of prepares its students for the Ivy Leagues. And so from there, it's a straight shot into into fame and glory and money. And so he ends up making these connections. He ends up meeting a whole bunch of investment bankers and financiers. And of course, he starts out in sort of the trading floor and sort of a low-end position. But somehow within a decade, he's a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And we don't really understand how that happened. We don't really understand where that money came from. We know that there were numerous companies that he created, mm-hmm. but it's something that is unknown to us. And of course, we know, thanks to some great investigating, that in 1980, he was Bachelor of the Month in Cosmopolitan magazine as a young financier. You know, how that happened, nobody really knows.
Oh my gosh. Well, the elephant in the room is whether or not Epstein was working for a foreign intelligence service. That would account for why he targeted the rich and the powerful to his private island for these sex dalliances with children. Epstein's girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, said that the Caribbean island house was completely wired for audio and video as an insurance policy. Those were her words. So the question then for you is, an insurance policy for what or against whom?
That, of course, also is an open question. We know that throughout Jeffrey Epstein's life, he was surrounded by people in intelligence, starting with Donald Barr, who had served in the OSS, all the way through to the end. And we know that, for example, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, there are ties that have been alleged with him and Mossad. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the idea of the house having all of this audio and visual equipment, the speculation is that it was to catch very important people in acts that were anything but, honorable, and using those as leverage or blackmail. And so, of course, that's what has been alleged. We don't mm-hmm. have the documentary evidence of that right now. There have been sources and various articles pointing to the fact that the FBI might have these videos and has kept them. But of course, what is portrayed in the videos is, of course, probably horrific crimes, pedophilia, right. and sexual abuse. So, of course, I don't think that those will ever go into the public domain. But the full breadth and depth of what was going on at the house is still a mystery to us.
Unbelievable. My own personal belief is that Epstein was a textbook access agent. And what I mean by that is that if you are a foreign intelligence service and you want sensitive information, let's say from a former president or from a prince, you can't just ask that person directly for information. So you recruit somebody who actually can ask directly. That might also account for the source of some of Epstein's money. What's your educated opinion on this? Are we looking at an intelligence operation here?
I believe so. That is the hypothesis that I think is most plausible. That's the only way that this whole story makes sense. And of course, we have to recognize the various interconnected persons and the nexus of relations here that made Jeffrey Epstein who he was. And so I think that there is no other explanation as to how Jeffrey Epstein became so powerful, so well-connected, and so well-financed, other than the explanation that he was an intelligence asset working for one or more intelligence services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another issue that I want to get out of the way is Epstein's suicide. He allegedly hanged himself in the notorious Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City before he could go on trial for the second time. The official explanation is that literally everything that could have gone wrong with the system went wrong. For example, the guards had worked 16-hour shifts instead of 8-hour shifts. They weren't making their rounds when they were supposed to. One of them actually was sleeping in the guard booth. The security cameras didn't work. Epstein had not been placed on suicide watch, even though he had threatened to commit suicide. He was placed in the cell with an accused murderer. Even the autopsy couldn't definitively state that the death was a suicide, even if it appeared to be a suicide. So, again, I'm just asking for an educated guess. Do you think Epstein killed himself? Was he allowed to kill himself, to silence him, or was he murdered?
I personally believe that he was murdered. I think the evidence points to that. I think that, of course, given the inconclusive nature of the autopsy report and the fact that all of these things happened miraculously simultaneously on the same night as this happened, I really do believe that Epstein was so powerful and well-connected in the sense that he knew so much that if, for example, he was given some sort of deal to expose what he knew, and had an opportunity to put it on the record in court, it would create, a tsunami for the rich and the powerful. And who knows what kind of damage it would have done for various governments and officials and politicians and who knows who. So, of course, I do think that that he did not commit suicide. I believe that he certainly was killed. By whom, I don't know. But that, of course, remains a mystery that we don't know the answers to.
You know, I think this is one of those situations that we're never really going to know the truth, whether he committed suicide, whether he was allowed to commit suicide, or whether he was murdered. But I will say that his death saved a lot of rich and powerful and important people a lot of trouble.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think the fact that all of this information, everything in the story remains somewhat piecemeal, somewhat inaccessible, especially the earlier story, which I helped to uncover with the earlier Black Book that we discovered from the 90s. A lot of names were not known up until that book was discovered in terms of his connections, over 300 new people in his web and his orbit. So I think that there's a lot that we've lost about that. And his death was convenient for many people.
Chris Hilali, don't go away. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, stick with us. When we come back, we're going to ask Chris Hilali why nearly 5 years after Jeffrey Epstein's death, we still don't know the details of exactly who he was associated with. Stay tuned.
When the world's largest democracy votes, the rest of the planet watches. In an emerging multipolar world, India's voice matters. But who will be the power behind it? Watch as almost 1 billion people decide and billions more react.
In the year of 1954, the United States of America engaged in warfare against the people of Vietnam. The White House supported the corrupt puppet government of Southern Vietnam. In 1965, Americans began their invasion following the aim to defeat the forces of Vietnamese patriots. The Pentagon was confident that the victory would be on the American side due to its military superiority. However, the Vietnamese turned this war into total hell for the occupants. Unable to cope with the guerrillas, the American Army started blanket bombing alongside using chemical weapons and napalm, which burnt all alive. The village of My Lai, where in 1969 American soldiers killed 504 civilians, including 210 children, became a tragic symbol of this war. All in all, during the whole period of this conflict, the USA dropped on Vietnam more than 6 million tons of bombs, which is 2.5 times as much as on Germany during the Second World War. In 1973, the American Army, under the pressure of the rebels, withdrew from Vietnam, and only 2 years later did the puppet regime in Saigon fall. However, the Vietnamese paid a high price for their freedom. More than 1 million Vietnamese people became the victims of American aggressors.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with investigative journalist Chris Hilali about investor, financier, and child sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Chris, great having you with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Chris, let's cut to the meat of this issue. Explain to us what these black books were, Why were they kept? Who kept them? And most importantly, where are they now?
So there are only two known black books that exist. One was discovered and brought to light in 2015 by investigative journalist Nick Bryant, who wrote The Franklin Scandal about another pedophilia ring. He brought it to light through Gawker, and that's the one that's currently in possession by the U.S. government. The FBI had that and seized it from one of Jeffrey Epstein's butlers, who was trying to pawn it off for some $50,000 or so. The second black book, which is an earlier version. So if this first black book is around mid-2000s, the earlier version, which I discovered and brought to light, by chance from an eBay sale,
oh my God,
was from the mid-90s. And so we were able to authenticate that book. That went that was published in 2021 by Business Insider with the help of Nick Bryant. And also we reached out to Julie K. Brown at the Miami Herald. So these two black books, basically what they are books, basically address and phone books, but they contain the details, phone numbers, even codes to some people's apartments, houses, buildings. And so they provide us with a web of relations. They provide us with an opportunity to really look at who was Jeffrey Epstein calling, who was he talking to. The earlier version that I have, as I mentioned, had over 300 new names that we had no idea, including John Katsimatidis, the Greek billionaire in New York, Suzanne Erka, many, many different people that we had no idea. And then, of course, there were some names that were in the first book that remained in the second book. So those were the people that we know had maintained relations and were very important. And some of those people are, of course, Donald Trump and others. The first book was during the Clinton presidency. So the line for Bill Clinton was the White House. Then later it was the Clinton private residence. Mm-hmm. So I think that all of these things provide us with an opportunity to see, well, who was in his world, since people haven't come forward and said, I knew him and we had dinner or we would go out on outings together. Nobody confessed to that until these books were brought forward to bring light to who was in his world.
So why do we not know the rest of the details from these black books? What more could we learn from them if they were to be released? Might the information answer questions like what were the likes of Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew doing on this sex island with underage girls? Is that the kind of thing that we could learn from this?
Really, what the black books teach us is who was in the contact list of Jeffrey Epstein. So the books detail the names of the people, names of important sites, give the numbers, passcodes. Most of the names have been released. Some have been redacted for various legal reasons, as I'm sure you and your viewers can understand, given the legal system. And of course, none of the phone numbers have been released. So those still are out there because some of the phone numbers are still legitimate. They're still being used by the people in the book. So these books, one that is still under my custody and careship, the other one still in government hands, these books really give us the sort of outline of relations. What the books don't necessarily do is give us, for example, as much detail as the flight logs and some of the other details and books that exist that gave us who was the manifests and things like that. These books don't do that, but what they do is provide us with an opportunity to see who did Jeffrey Epstein think was so important in his world to keep close by his person.
Might we expect to learn information that would answer the question of whether or not Epstein was working with a foreign intelligence service? Does any actual evidence of that exist? Is that a question that could conceivably be answered if you put the different pieces of information available in the books together?
Certainly, one of the things that I have been working on is sort of creating a web, sort of if you were to think about it as the classic idea of this board with all these lines, right? All these strings of yarn going to different names. The question ultimately is, with all of these names, with hundreds of names, who is in finance? Who is in the arts? Who's in culture? Who's in politics? And then what you end up doing is you go to the next layer. Who has ties to different governments? who works on behalf of the defense industries, who works on behalf of organizations or entities that might have close relationships historically or contemporary with intelligence. And I think that work is still ongoing. That hasn't really been fleshed out because there are people, of course, who might be working for intelligence that we don't know that they're working for intelligence. But this provides us with an opportunity to really create that web of relations. And I think that this is an ongoing process. This work is still many years before we get to some sort of clarity, if we ever do.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Chris, who do you think was behind the protection of Jeffrey Epstein? We spoke earlier about the sweetheart deal that he received in 2006 when he was sentenced to 18 months in the Palm Beach, Florida jail rather than to a much tougher state prison. The prosecutor at the time, Alexander Acosta, who later became a member of Donald Trump's cabinet, said that he had been told that Epstein was, quote, intelligence, unquote, and that powerful people, whom he described as far above his pay grade, had demanded leniency for Epstein. Can you shed any light on this? What are we supposed to take from it?
I think what we can take from it is the following, that if Jeffrey Epstein worked in intelligence, as I believe, and I believe many of your viewers believe, or at least think is plausible, I think then we go to the next layer, which is who in his orbit could have been, paying him, who could have been working for him, he could have worked for. And I honestly believe, given his closeship with the former prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, the Mossad is a very plausible possibility here, given the fact also that Ghislaine Maxwell was so, of course, tied to this entire story, was not only his girlfriend, but helped to get the girls, and of course, the relation with her father. I think also given his proximity to U.S. former presidents and politicians, and of course, Prince Andrew in the U.K., this could have been not only one, but three. It could have been MI6 mm-hmm. and, at least aspects of U.S. intelligence. What that looked like, how that relationship worked, I believe it was probably off the record. I believe as some intelligence operations, work, as you well know, sometimes things are done behind the scenes with a few operatives, not really with the knowledge of the overall agency. And I think that this was one of those scenarios that it might have been an opportunity to do this kind of operation off the books and outside of the purview and outside of the jurisdiction of maybe an inspector general or somebody who would be closely monitoring this, or it was farmed out to a foreign intelligence service that could take the brunt should something go wrong. So I do think that absolutely, with what Acosta was mentioning there, mm-hmm. I think that these are the crumbs, these are sort of the pieces that help paint the picture that Epstein was, in fact, an intelligence asset. But for whom, that remains, that's still the question. That remains to be seen.
I have to agree. There are such things as off-the-books intelligence operations. And when you're talking about trying to draw into a web, people as important as former presidents of the United States, senior members of the British royal family, the most important businessmen in the world, billionaires, and people who influence governmental policy or even societal policy, you're going to want to keep things like that off the books. One final question I have for you is, when do you think there was this change from Epstein trying to make as much money as he possibly could, Epstein trying to become a billionaire, let's say, to Epstein, the intelligence service asset?
I think that happens in the 90s. And I think that's why the black book that I discovered and brought to light is so critical, is that that was the transition point. We know that Epstein, through the 80s and into the 90s, was working for various financial firms. He had started his own company, which was trying to recover stolen assets from certain very prominent people. And so that was when he was working in finance. Really, in the mid to late 90s is when we begin to see a transition. And then, of course, we have evidence from the early 2000s where all of these crimes begin. So really, that's the pivotal point. What's interesting about that time period, I think, is the fact that we have a global transformation happening simultaneously, right? We're having the end of the 90s, the end of the Clinton administration, and then we're hit with 9/11 and then the global war on terror. Mm-hmm. Whether those things are separate or interconnected, I think that there is some interesting timeline facts here that we can begin to layer and wonder what was going on. And of course, it's important to recognize that Epstein was close to Adnan Khashoggi, who of course was related to Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered,
yes,
right, by the Saudi state, right? And Adnan was very important during in arms trade and during the insurgency in Afghanistan, or the Mujahideen struggle against the Soviet army there. So of course, mm-hmm, these kinds of things are important to kind of bring to light and recognize. And I think that we're going to learn more as time goes on, and I hope that more will come to light over time.
Thanks for piecing that together. I'll add that that Adnan Khashoggi was one of the most important, one of the most prominent arms dealers in the world through the 1980s and the 1990s. I think you're exactly right, Chris, and I think you're onto something very important here. Chris Hilali, I want to thank you for joining us today and for sharing your insights. We were happy to have you. Thanks to our viewers for taking the time to be with us today. Former Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi once said, quote, "We must protect families, we must protect children who have inalienable rights and should be loved, should be taken care of physically and mentally, and should not be brought into the world only to suffer," unquote. Jeffrey Epstein and his friends made children suffer. None of them have really paid any price. That's unacceptable. And even though Epstein is now dead, it's up to the rest of us to continue fighting for that truth. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.